From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Reports that the FBI and Congress may be getting into the censorship business in the United States. According to a report in the Russian news agency RT, the company that supplies TV production and operations services for its U.S. outlet RT America has received a letter from the U.S. Department of Justice claiming that the company is obliged to register under the Foreign Agents Registration Act, a law which was adopted in 1938 to counter pro-Nazi agitation on U.S. soil. According to the report Tuesday at RT.com, at present there are 401 entities in the active FARA register, which include tourist boards and lobbyists. However, there are not currently any media outlets listed. These have traditionally been considered exempt from the legislation. In a statement cited in the RT report, the agency's editor-in-chief, Martiriga Simonian, said, quote, "The war the U.S. establishment is waging with our journalists is dedicated to all these starry-eyed idealists who still believe in freedom of speech. Those who invented it," she said, "have buried it." This past summer, Democratic Senator Gene Shaheen from New Hampshire, together with House Democrat David Chicolin from Rhode Island and House Republican Matt Gaetz from Florida, sponsored a bill called the Foreign Agents Registration Modernization and Enforcement Act, which would broaden the scope of FARA. Shaheen has previously claimed that what she called Russian propaganda has, as she put it, a body count. She and her House co-sponsors have specifically named RT as a target of the proposed legislation, which has yet to go to a vote in either House. RT Simonian condemned the proposed legislation, saying in a statement last week, quote, "I wonder how U.S. media outlets, which have no problems while working in Moscow and that are not required to register as foreign agents, will treat this initiative," closed quote. Meanwhile, the FBI is also reportedly probing another Russian news agency for possible FARA violations, the English-language Moscow-headquartered news outlet Sputnik. Yahoo News reported that the Sputnik investigation centers on Andrew Feinberg, a former White House correspondent for the agency. RT reported that Feinberg, after being fired in May, handed over a thumb drive containing thousands of internal Sputnik emails and documents. According to various reports, Feinberg said he was interviewed by FBI agents for 2 hours and reportedly told Yahoo News that, quote, "They wanted to know where did my orders come from and if I ever got any direction from Moscow. They were interested in examples of how I was steered towards covering certain issues," closed quote. Mindy Agavishelli, editor-in-chief of the Sputnik Bureau in Washington, D.C., dismissed the investigation of his agency, which Yahoo News said could also be part of the wider Robert Mueller investigation into alleged Russian meddling in last year's election. Gavishelli issued a statement that said in part, quote, "that an investigation is being conducted against us is not surprising, since the atmosphere of hysteria in relation to everything that belongs to Russia has been created in the country, and everything with the word Russian is seen through the prism of spy mania. We are journalists and mostly Americans work here. We believe that any assumption that we're engaged in anything other than journalism is an absolute lie and fabrication," closed quote. We'll have more on that tomorrow. Meanwhile, today, we move to the 9th installment of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the development of the Soviet state and economy from the period beginning with the 1917 revolution and running through the dissolution of the Soviet Union in December of 1991.
As we discussed last time, we outlined the policies, the policy of the Popular Front, which was replacing the policy of antagonism toward social democracy between 1920, toward social democratic parties that was the policy of the Comintern, of the Sixth Comintern, from 1928 to 1935. Okay, so the Popular Front policy was formalized as the official policy of the World Communist Movement in 1935, casting aside, as I mentioned, the old third party, the old third period line of class against class. And as I said before, the Popular Front policy was to defend the Russian Revolution by supporting mutual defense agreements between the USSR and various capitalist states. I'm just kind of repeating what we said last time.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
So, not very well. Okay, so the Seventh Comintern appointed as their head Georgi Dimitrov, who was an advocate of the Popular Front, and appointed him as the new head of the Communist International. Now, people will remember Georgi Dimitrov as one of the people accused in Germany of the Reichstag fire. Do I have to explain what that is?
Just very briefly, this was the Reichstag fire, is the fire in the Reichstag building, the German parliament, essentially enabled Hitler to become the supreme ruler of Germany, thanks to the von Hindenburg's enabling law and his appointment of Hitler as chancellor and such. All kind of happened altogether. They blame the communists. Most people, most modern historians believe, in fact, that the Nazis either did it themselves or some lone nut did it. But Dimitrov has been the poster child for the people who blame the communists.
Yes. And there was a trial in Leipzig, and he was acquitted and returned to Moscow in 1934 to eventually head the Seventh Comintern Congress. Now, he was determined to change the strategy from one of antagonism to social democracy to one of cooperation in a joint struggle against this new threat, this fascism. Now, he had been convinced in his view because he had observed the February 1934 uprising of socialists against right-wing forces in Austria. And also, he had observed the movement toward cooperation between socialists and communists in France in fighting a nascent fascist movement there. So, in his as he reported to the Comintern, in his assessment, hostility toward joint action between communists and socialists was ill-considered in this context, in this time, now that capitalism had opted for fascism, as we mentioned last time, between 1928 and 1933 or so, before Hitler's rise, the interpretation of the communists was that capitalism was on its last legs, the implosion of internal markets of the capitalist countries would cause a new radical situation in which the proletarian could take power or something like that. Now, the other advocate of the United Front was the leader of the Communist Party of Germany, Wilhelm Peck, and he also argued at the Seventh Comintern that the Sixth Comintern policy of class against class, which was directed against the bloc of the Soviet Democrats, the bloc of the Social Democrats with the bourgeoisie, he said at this point it would be counterproductive in the struggle against fascism. So he pointed out that because markets internal to capitalist countries had collapsed and profits had declined, the dire economic situation for capitalism had intensified the push toward a seizure and plunder of foreign territory under the banner of fascism. Right. Fascism and imperialism are twins.
Right.
Historically, you know, for reasons.
Yeah, and you know,
and
just
said, let me, okay, sorry.
Go ahead. I just wanted to insert here, you know, just two things. One in particular, the you know, the idea that capitalism had reached the crisis, the existential crisis, with the collapse at the end of the 1920s, it makes a lot of sense if people understand the fact that John Maynard Keynes and others, you know, Franklin Roosevelt, these different experiments that took place where they used credit and other tools to blow air back into the economy after these collapses, you know, that hadn't happened yet. There was no real record of experience with those kinds of manipulations of the economy. And also the scale of intervention in the economy that these kinds of things required by the state, or by state-sponsored institutions, hadn't happened either, except in socialist economy, particularly except in the USSR, and then sort of its evil twin, almost the mirror image of it that was shaping up in Germany, where the state was heavily intervening, but rather than on behalf of workers, it was on behalf of capital.
Yeah, it's interesting to ask the question why Germany, Italy opted for, you know, German and Italian capitalist industrialist opted for fascism, and the United States did not.
Well, that is that assumes
sort of an answer.
Yeah, I'd like to hear that, because that assumes, though, that the United States did not. And if you were black living in the South, for example, in 1933, you might not agree that they didn't.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes. There's always the racial component together with the class here. Oh, definitely. The 1920s were lynching time that forced the immigration to the North.
Yep.
But there was fascism in the United States. I mean, sympathy for it, sympathy for the leader, and that was Ford. You know, most the Fords,
Father
contingent,
Coghlan and all these folks,
pushing for it. But my suspicion is that the United States had enough reserves or wealth to be able to pass the Keynesian economics and give some to the people to take them away from revolt.
Right.
In other words, it could afford not to go fascist.
Right. As Germany was able to do, and Italy, until the crises that, you know, that ushered fascism in those places. And the U.S., although it had the economic and financial collapse that took place contemporaneously, it was, the nature of it was not the same. And as we saw, it just took a little air blowing by the Roosevelt and the Alphabet City agencies to get started a little bit. And then, of course, World War II was the real Keynesian impetus there.
Yeah, and for Germany it was the
militarization,
the Versailles Treaty and the debt as well.
Yep, that's right, too, yep.
But anyway, Peck said that the on this business of
the question of the United Front. We're talking about Peck.
Yeah. Well, he said that the aggression of militarist Japan in Manchuria and the rise of Nazi Germany epitomized a new trend toward robbing other countries for the wealth that was depleting in their own countries.
Right.
But I find one of Peck's quotes of the Seventh Comintern very interesting, very trenchant. he said that these preparations for imperialism and war are simultaneously and primarily designed for the destruction of the Soviet Union, the home, the bases, and the bulwark of the proletarian revolution. It wasn't just to rob the world, but it was also to isolate and destroy the Soviet Union.
Right.
So the policies of the United Front were almost immediately tested in Spain, and I seek your advice on whether we should go into this later, rather than, because Trotsky enters into this, at least the Trotsky party enters into this. So should we talk about the test in Spain if we had time later on in the program?
Yeah, let's defer that. It maybe just a very, very brief reference to it now, because I think even, you know, when we get later on in this series and we start drawing parallels and, you know, discussing in any event parallels to what's happening today, that'll be the time to flesh those things out, because people are sort of invoking the 1920s and 30s as analog almost every day, even on CNN, and they're doing it very badly, and perhaps the time to lay out the details, the factual basis of what happened, you know, back then, that would be, while it's be, you know, people are trying to apply the history of then to now, we can correct their history and see what, how that changes what is to be done today.
Yes, where so much of it is distorted.
Yes.
Well, so, so should I go into, so that was the internal, what I've talked about, the United Front was a response to the rise of fascism.
Yes.
To the rise of Hitler, you know, a specific type of fascism.
Right.
Which was, which had this terrible racist component explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
That was the external threat, but something momentous was also happening in the Soviet Union, and that I sort of label as the internal threat to the cohesion of the Communist Party. Now, this internal threat manifested itself with the assassination of Sergei Kirov in 1934. Kirov was the party chief of the Communist Party in Leningrad. He was, it's called the boss.
Right.
And he was assassinated by going into his small knee office, and there's all sorts of big stories about this. But anyway, I'm just going to say he was assassinated in 1934. Kirov was a particularly favorite in the party. He was second to Stalin in power, and he was extremely popular as Leningrad party chief. And if Stalin was to fail or be removed, he would certainly be the second, the one to take power, because in the central committee elections, he got 3 votes fewer than Stalin.
Right.
And now, you know, Kirov was assassinated, and we have this legend that Stalin killed Kirov. Now, Stalin and Kirov were very close.
Right.
Very close friends. They, I mean, Stalin had to go to to Leningrad to meet Kirov because Kirov didn't like Moscow, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I don't want to go into gossip here. But in 1956, Khrushchev launched the attack or the lie that Stalin had manufactured the assassination of Kirov.
Right.
This remains in the legend today. If you read Lonely Planet,
mm-hmm.
it talks about the Kirov Museum, visiting the Kirov Museum, and it says, Kirov lived for 10 years at this flat until his murder at Stalin's behest in 1934.
Right.
Which sparked a wave of deadly repression in the country. Now, here's the Gorbachev period in 1989. There was an investigation, and after two into the Kirov facts,
right.
After 2 years of investigation, Gorbachev's working team at the commission concluded that, quote, in this affair, no materials objectively support Stalin's participation or the NKVD participation in the organization and carrying out of Kirov murder.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there it is. But they continue to repeat this story. And however, at the time, what happened was that the investigation into his assassination, you know, in 1934, led to the discovery of sedition within the party.
Right.
Which resulted in three explosive Moscow trials for treason.
Right.
The trial of Tukhachevsky, General Tukhachevsky and his military circle, the trial of Kamenev and Zinoviev, and of the Trotsky's faction. And again, we need to talk about this when we focus on, you know, those years. So the repression took off. What we know as the Great Purge of the 1930s, in which it is said that many old Bolsheviks were arrested, expelled from the party, and executed. That's you know, the official.
Right.
Complicity in Kirov's assassination was a common charge, to which the accused confessed in the show trial of the period. I'm quoting Wikipedia here. Just
yeah, right.
Because
I'm looking at
none
that
of
too.
This, all of this is...
bunk.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's all of it's bunk. I know. It's like a narrative written by HUAC in 1953 or something. It's really absurd, actually. But and by the way, I'd like to know if there's anyone on planet Earth that could call Gorbachev a Stalinist. So, you know, when Gorbachev's committee is saying there's no evidence linking Stalin to this, you know, that's about as authoritative as the Pope saying it.
You know. Yes, because he had no interest in finding the exoneration of Stalin.
And saying it ex officio, by the way. You know, it's like, so it's, you can't even make an error. But yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I mean, this repression that took off is ironic. I mean, you know, I don't know even what to call it. There was,
a
repression
yeah.
of treason.
Well,
you know, treasonous.
You had on the one hand a new policy that was being implemented, one of a united front. On the other hand, you had an acknowledgement and a recognition, actually at a more sophisticated level, of the fact that there's a class war going on. This state operates on behalf of the working class, and there were enemies of the working class operating inside the government and the country at a very hazardous time. As it turns out, I mean, because another slander that's thrown at Stalin is that he fired the generals and almost lost World War II because of that.
Yeah.
When in fact, all of these things that guaranteed at least some measure of integrity of the state at the time that Operation Barbarossa took place meant that they won. Stalin won. He beat Hitler. So for all of the armchair generals and the guy that got shot in Mexico, who's such a genius, for all of them to throw the slander, it ignores the largest fact in history, you know?
It was Russian hackers.
Yeah, Russian. Putin did it. He wasn't born yet, but he did it anyway. I'm sorry. Go ahead. So, you know, I'm getting...
Yeah, no, don't be sorry. It's funny. So let's call it the repression because we can't do anything else.
Right.
Now, this event, Kirov trials, is so ironic because the Soviet government was drafting a new constitution at this time,
right.
Started in 1934.
Right, the Constitution of 1936, yeah. It's called. It's called the Constitution of 1936, that's right.
Yeah, that's when that's when it was approved. Now, this new constitution you know, was being drafted because the path to socialism, Lenin said, and everybody agreed, could only be, and Marx agreed, could only be achieved through democracy, but, you know, through democracy, but not bourgeois democracy,
right,
which is a sham. Right. So, for example, this is an absurd example, but the Constitution guaranteed the freedom of religion or religious thought, as well as the criticism of it. So, you know, it wasn't just an atheist opinion that
right.
This is in the Constitution. Now, the discussion of the project lasted 5.5 months. It was discussed by 25 million Soviet citizens in workshops and in factories, in the villages and in the barracks, in the universities, among the tenants of the big houses. Only after the discussion, the Constitution was adopted as the fundamental law of the state by the Congress of the Soviets, in which the delegates were 42% workers, 40% peasants, and 18% Soviet intellectuals.
Yep.
This was true. Now, however, this perfect storm was gathering over Soviet land, marked by the external Nazi threat, the internal sedition, signaled by the murder of Kirov. And this brings us to the case of Bukharin and his right opposition within the Communist Party. Now, we have discussed previously the collectivization of agriculture, and which was made possible by and after the expropriation and removal of the capitalist class of the kulaks.
Right.
The Communist Party had approved this measure, a kind of class struggle within the peasant class, which was divided among rich, middle, and poor peasants. And the idea was to remove the exploitation by rich, by the kulaks, of the poor peasant. Now, the struggle had been successful, had practically funded the cost of rapid industrialization, and especially the development of heavy industry. And as we have seen, unemployment was zero. In just 5 years, from 1933 to 1937, the wage fund increased in the Soviet Union from 34 billion rubles to 96.5 billion rubles.
Almost tripled.
The average annual wage for a worker rose from 1,513 rubles in 1933 to 3,447 rubles
wow.
in 1937.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Their wages tripled while people in the U.S. were on bread lines.
Yeah. Brother, can you spare me
a dime?
Sure.
Right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
But within the Communist Party, there was a group of communists who opposed these measures. And this was the group around Bukharin. And it was called the Right Opposition. Existed, you know, forever. There was a left opposition and the right opposition. Now, the Bukharin platform was open and declared and had been discussed. It was no secret. And it opposed the policy chosen by the party in 1928. Continuing to do so throughout the five-year plan, which ended in 33. Now, the Bukharin platform demanded, one, a slowing down of the pace of development of industry. Two, limiting cooperative farm so as not to restrict activities of the kulaks. And three, continuing market freedom, market economy, freedom to conduct private trade and commerce, and thus, and also a waiver of central planning control in matters of trade. This sounds like what Khrushchev will do in 1956,
yes,
and we'll get back to this, because there is a line, Bukharin, Khrushchev, Gorbachev, which we might explore in the future.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.